Hey there, I'm Brian Kateman, host of the Reducitarian Podcast, where I speak to experts in their field about how to accomplish a concrete goal that advances our shared mission for a more sustainable, healthy, and compassionate world. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hey, Andrew, thanks so much for being on the Reducitarian Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. I'm excited to be here.
Of course, we're thrilled to have you. I'm a huge fan of you and your product and company. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there who have this idea for a product, and maybe they're even at the stage where, you know, they've got it ready to go, but they don't exactly know how to communicate about it. And most importantly, they don't know how to get it onto shelves. They don't know how to get it into grocery stores and realtors and retailers rather. And I think that you're an amazing person to talk to about that. So I'm really excited to have you on.
Great. Yeah. I'm excited to share how we took it from one store to nationwide. It's been a journey. So really the inspiration happened due to a real life situation. It was a need that I had in my life, which was, how do I feed my family? How do I feed my picky daughter vegetables?
Right.
That's then there. And how do I not have as many fights? How do I not argue as much, and how do I turn mealtimes into something that doesn't have to be so much of a debate, but I can feel good about, and she can feel good about as well. So it really, the inspiration behind Odomat was, how do I make this one meal, this one pizza night, a little more healthy? And so I simply grabbed a bunch of veggies, steamed them up, made a sauce. It came out a little pink. There was no business intent to start. And I think that's really key. If you try to start out something and you're trying to create something brand new, and if you try to force fit it, it's kind of, I think it's just ripe for errors. It's more of like those things that hit you in the shower, or the things that you just struggle with so much. And I love to cook and I love to eat. And I always struggle with, how do I have my son and daughter eat better? Because they have so much ketchup, they have plenty of pizza and pasta. And how do I pivot that a little bit? I mean, I love to cook. And I would spend hours and hours in the kitchen trying to like make a new kind of, you know, this for them or that for them. And I made the sauce and then I thought, wait a minute. If I'm having this problem, maybe other people are too. And so I'd ask a couple of people. I asked my sister, and I have four younger sisters actually. And some of them have kids, a couple of them, and they all have that issue. And I said, you know what? My daughter's classmates, parents probably have that problem too. And then I thought, okay, I don't have a background in food. I have a background in building businesses and always trying to do something, right? But I've never done food before. And so that was really, she inspired me to kind of go on this journey and take that leap of faith of, can I turn this thing that I just made for her in the kitchen into an actual business?
Very cool. All right. And so what does it look like to, you know, have an idea for a product or a company and then actually formalize it? And particularly, how do you start thinking about the brand? You know, what does it look like? It's messaging. I mean, what goes into kind of thinking about all the components?
Yeah, I think there's this one part that I feel as an entrepreneur, because I've started a lot of businesses and a lot don't work out and some do, but you try to learn about them along the way. And one thing I feel that I got the hardest part, one of the hardest parts, is to get comfortable with telling people about your idea, right? I feel like I did this other business where I'd kind of be in the cave in the lab in my basement. Like, I didn't want to tell anyone. I remember being not so nice to my banker. And when I went to the bank and they asked you, what is this business about? And I would kind of say, why do you have to know that? You know, like, what is it? My banker going to steal the idea? Come on. So at first you have to be comfortable about, you know, you have to realize that there's 99%, you know, inspiration, but it's that 1% perspiration. It's that one, it's who you can have great ideas. There's a ton, there's limitless ideas out there, but how many people are actually going to make it real? Because that's really, really hard to turn an idea into something real and keep at it. Sure, we are where we are today, national with Whole Foods and Sprouts, et cetera, Wegmans, but it doesn't happen overnight. You're looking at 3 years of hard work that really went into it. There were 2 years before we hit that first store in Brooklyn, before we hit that first shelf, there were two and a half years that went into that product from the inspiration to actually even having a single jar and a single shelf.
Wow.
So there's a lot that goes into it. So, you know, the first thing I would say is get comfortable being uncomfortable. Get comfortable letting people know about an idea that you've held close to your chest. Of course, start with people that are close to you, people that you can trust, okay? And then figure out, well, how can you test that idea quickly and efficiently? And get comfortable that you might put it out there and someone might try to go grab it and copy it very quickly, right? Sure, there's always a chance of that, right? And guess what? If it's that easy to copy, maybe it's not that great of an idea. Maybe, right? And you would think throwing veggies in a jar, and sure, I've thought that, hey, that's an easy thing to copy. But we spent over two years coming up with that formula. And to put 10 organic veggies in a jar to that consistency, to that scalability, to be able to keep the nutrients in the way that we do, it's really hard. I mean, I partnered with a really great chef. We partnered with a great co-packer in the beginning that was willing to take on a startup. But I would say the first step is be comfortable asking questions, because you're not gonna know much, and I'm still learning every single day, and I love it. But the hardest part mentally for me was getting that idea into the heads of other people so that they can help me work through the challenges I was about to encounter.
And the challenges are you talking about, do you sort of mean them broadly? Like, how do I go about finding a chef, or how do I go about finding a co-packer? Yeah. And then
all kinds.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many. So the first challenge one person I told, it's a really good older friend of mine, and in the advertising world, because that's my 9-to-5. I work in advertising, and I went to his name's John, and I said, John, I have this idea. It's it might be kind of silly, and I said, I want to make the world's healthiest tomato sauce. And he said, well, you should speak to my stepson. He's and it turns out that his stepson is a world famous chef, which I just never knew. I've known John for many, many years. And it turns out his son is a James Beard Award winning chef. Wow. Has written a book on the science of cooking, the art and science of cooking, 2,500 pages, on that. And he has studied the things that cooking can do to food, affects it, at a molecular level. And so when I sat down, and we chatted about this, he's like, Andrew, this is right up my alley. I love this stuff. And so right there is kind of where a light bulb moment turned into a floodlight moment, right? I found and that was problems that I've had in the past, is who your initial partners are. Because I've had ideas, but it's really, you have to have that chemistry, and you have to have someone who's willing to go on that first phase of your journey with you to really take on the challenge of doing something that hasn't been done before, right? And so that, just by me opening my mouth and opening my closed shell of, I don't want to tell anyone, to telling some trusted friends, said, hey, you should meet with this person. And then you start to tell, another person, the next big challenge, at least in food and a lot of things, is who's going to make this product that you've invented, right? Mm-hmm. And honestly, that was the other, that was maybe the biggest challenge in the search for a co-packer, almost, The time it took about a year to find a co-packer, and we had about 49 no's until we finally got a yes. And trust me, I almost gave up after no 40, no 41, no 42, no 43, right?
Wow.
It was just like, you get tired of it, and you start to feel bad. And you're like, I have my friends and family's money that they trusted in me to do this, and I've spent it to make this prototype of a product that I can't even make scalable. And then you start to feel like bad. And then you start to feel like, should I just reimburse them? Should I, what do I do? Like, I don't want to be a loser, right? Yeah. But at the same time, I don't want to keep, I don't want to, turn this into a money pit, and I don't want to, and it's a tiring thing. It's taxing, especially if you have, the family, I have a wife and two kids at home, and it's like, and it's a toll, because I have a day job, still have a day job. And then I'm doing all this. And at some point, they're like, when are you going to spend time with us? It's the weekend and you're dealing with calls. Oh, I got to do this and that. It's hard. It takes a lot of support from the family, which I've had, and I'm very lucky about that. But the co-packer search was probably, that was key. And finally finding someone to say yes was like gold.
So let's talk about the co-packer search, because that's come up a couple of times on this podcast. And so, what is the function of a co-packer? How do you go about figuring out who to reach out to? And then what's going to, I guess, increase the chances that they'll say yes? Or do you just, you sort of just be who you are and you hope you find the right partner? And how did you actually go about finding the one that that ultimately accepted you?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So there's a couple ways to go about it. One way, Google is always your friend, right? The word, just knowing that word co-packer is key. Because people, they think that a food business, oh, everyone makes their own food. No, Barilla Sauces uses a co-packer, right? Like, until you get to a certain size and a certain scale, even if you are, you're probably using a co-packer because it mitigates your risk. Are you going to spend, because not, you're going to have to not only spend millions on equipment, but I'll never have the buying power of like a Heinz, right? In terms of they're buying their tomatoes super cheap. Like I'm always going to be, so I'm going to want to go with someone that's currently, you know, making, or buying products, but we don't use the Barilla guys. They use some big plant. I mean, they're doing millions of jars a day or whatever it is. But in terms of the next steps, I would say there's a big association. It's called the Private Label Manufacturing Association, PLMA. So if you're new to food, that is an annual conference that happens. Last year was in Chicago, and it is a gathering of co-packers, essentially. So you find people that, now a lot of times these co-packers cannot tell you who they're making stuff for. Even if you find their website, 99 out of 100 will not tell you that they're making stuff for Trader Joe's or Whole Foods or whatever it is, right?
Right.
Because private label is a big game and people don't want to know, you know, who's making what for who. Until you're actually walking on your own plant floor and see other stuff that's there. I mean, you have NDAs and, you know, you can't say. But, you know, I would say the first step, an easy step, would be to go to the PLMA website and poke around on there. Also, the Specialty Foods Association that does the fancy food show here in New York and also in California, they have a great list. They have people on their websites. And I think you might not have to be a member to poke around there. And then there's just Google. You know, there's great lists on Google saying, I had my sister looking for a popcorn company. And she's like, can you give me, like, she had someone that wanted to make private label popcorn, you know, a new kind of recipe or something. And I found her, you know, it took maybe a half hour, but between a couple of these lists and Google, I found her 10 different popcorn companies. So that's step one, right? Identifying a set of co-packers. Step two, which you mentioned, which is a great question, is how do you get them to pay attention to you, right?
Right.
Here I am, Andrew, works in advertising, I don't have any track record, right? I have a zero batting average. I've never even been to the plate making food before. So how do I get a co-packer first comfortable with talking to me, picking up the phone, right? I don't even think we had a website at that point. So we weren't even an established brand. It was just an idea, a pipe dream. And then second, how does that start to work financially and mechanically? So, you know, what was key for that is the initial set of questions you need to put together. You have to be ready to ask them some questions that will help qualify them if they're a good partner for you. One of them is, what is your MOQ? Meaning, what is your minimum order quantity? So right off the bat, you can essentially be really efficient with your time if you have these set of questions, copy and paste them into emails to your 10 or 20 co-packers that you think might be a good fit for you. If they come back and say, our MOQ is a quarter million, which I had right at first, that was some of the responses, they're off the list. You shouldn't spend any more time. You shouldn't even get on a phone call with them, right? So being really, really mindful of your time is key.
Because that's too expensive, is the right?
Oh, because I don't even know if one person's going to buy it, let alone 250,000 people are going to buy a jar. So you want to go with, of course, you have to gamble somewhat. And so our first MOQ was something like 2,500 jars. Enough that I was like, you know what? I'll flip these out of the trunk of my car if I have to. You know, I'll make the world's biggest pizza pie, whatever it is. And so finding a co-packer, one, that will have a lower MOQ. And then there might be other things. Are you organic certified? Are you not? Or, you know, and just really understanding, do you take this on? Do you buy ingredients that I need already? Meaning, will you be able to, you know, my COGS? Because, you know, some people might have the equipment, but if they're not buying butternut squash and peppers and tomatoes and sweet onions and things like that we put on our sauce, if they're not already buying at least 80% of that stuff, your pricing is going to be, you know, your pricing is going to be pretty expensive, you know?
Right.
And that's the thing. Initially, our initial co-packer, we're on to our second co-packer, who I love and I think we'll stick with for a long time. Our first co-packer, we had to provide a lot of those ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so I was absolutely paying a premium. But I had to think about it like, this is today's price. This is not tomorrow's price. This is not national price. This is not when we get into 50 or 100 or 1,000 stores. But you have to, so you have to be mindful of that too. And you may even have to, you know, eat away at, you know, be ready to not make, definitely be ready to not make any money for a little while. I'll put that out there, okay? And especially in the beginning, because you're, you know, if you want to compete, you're competing, whatever product you're making, there will be something similar. You know, of course there's similar tomato sauces, but if you want to do new chocolate, a new popcorn, there's going to be something similar in there. Even if it's a brand new kind of snack, right? There are tons of snacks out there. And so your price needs to be in that range. And we're on the higher end of the tomato sauces, right? But in the beginning, our jars, now we're $6.99 on the shelf nationwide. And that's very important to me. But at first we were like $9, $10, $11 on the shelf, right?
Right.
And it was nuts, but it was kind of what we were, we needed to be. But eventually your COGS go down and your price goes down and it works out.
And I imagine this is where having a very clever, smart, clear brand comes into play, right? Because you want to build an early customer base. You want to be able to communicate the values. You're an advertising guy. So I imagine you must have some perspective on how you talk about, you know, coming up with the name of your company, the branding, the colors. I love that the ingredients are on the front of the bottle. To walk us through that kind of branding component.
Yeah. So I'm on the advertising side for 20 years, but I'm okay at Photoshop, but I'm not a designer. I'm not a copywriter. I try to. The copy on the back of the bottle is always fun for me to craft. Sometimes there might be a spelling error that we catch before printing, which is nice. But the branding is so key, because you can have a great product, but if it doesn't grab people's attention, if it doesn't quickly communicate your brand values and what you're about, and essentially what's in your product, I think you're going to have a hard time really making it. So at least that's our approach. I'm lucky in that one of my businesses, we work with advertising agencies. I have this financial management company that we work with advertising agencies, and just being in the whole advertising world, which I am. I brought on a group of friends to really help me out. The first one just did something. It was very simple, and it's my friend James did something. It really inspired. The first time you see someone design a package for you that's photorealistic, even though it's not real, that was like, whoa, that's like that gets you up. That gets you up like a double espresso right there. When you're like, someone shows you like what this might be. You're like, wow. Like, then you start to have this vision of the whole thing that someone else, that's the first person to share that vision of a product coming to life. The branding then, but typically, at least what we did is we hired an agency, who helped us with our, design, with our, you know, positioning a bit, and being an ad guy, it made it a little bit easier for me to kind of work and be in tandem with that and essentially play to creative director on that. Copy director and things. But bringing in a really strong branding team is key, not only for the packaging, but the next thing you need to work on right away, the next couple of things after you do your product packaging. One, you're going to need a sell sheet.
What's
so
that?
So you're going to go to a sell sheet. So a sell sheet is essentially a one page or back and front, 8.5 by 11, that talks about your product. And on the other side of it, it'll show your product, your SKU, how many come in a box, how many come on a pallet, the weight, all that kind of transactional information. And it's okay if you don't know, like you don't have pallets of it yet, just some basic information, meaning it's something that you can leave with a grocery store or a buyer saying, this is my product. If you want to buy it, here's the information, right? I would recommend not putting your price on there, right? You can maybe staple it as a black and white sheet, because those prices will fluctuate and you're probably going to spend a lot on this glossy thing. We have a sell sheet, I like it. I can share it on the podcast if it helps. And it's, you know, but it has to, the sell sheet is simply a product information sheet that helps a buyer understand what you're about, as well as, you know, all the key information, your nutrients, your label, your case pack, your tie highs, which is all of your palette information. So that's one. So you have your packaging, then you need your sell sheet, because that's kind of what your leave behind is. When you go to a store, the manager is not in. You got to leave them something. You can't just leave a jar of sauce there. You got to leave that and something that's professional. It also will say, who can they buy it from? So if you're with Unify or a distributor, you're going to put their logos on there. Maybe you're even going to put your item ID in there to make it super easy. You need to make that seamless because they're getting pitched all day.
And so when you say go into a store, are you saying like you, so I understand, right? You've had this idea for your product, you've tested it, you managed to identify the recipe, you found a co-packer who's going to create it for you. And now you've kind of worked with a design firm, marketing firm to really think about the messaging, the colors, the design. But then you want stores to essentially sell the product. You don't maybe just want to sell it online. So how would you go about doing that? Would you personally walk into the stores with Excel sheet, or what is that like?
Oh yeah. So there's two ways to go about it. And the first way you should go is yourself, because you need to hear from the buyers if they like it or if they don't. And if they don't like it, why don't you like it? Is it my price? Is it because you have too many of these? Like, you need to actually have those conversations with buyers. We were lucky in that when we launched back in March of 2019, and we had a trade show just a month or two after that. It was a plant-based food show here in New York City, their first year. Quickly thereafter was like Fancy Food and Things. And you have buyers that are walking around and coming to your booth saying, I like your stuff. Here in New York City, one of the most exciting ones was Zabar's came up to us, and the guy gives me his card, Scott. And I didn't know who he was, you know, just we're chatting. And then he gives me his card. He's like, bring a couple cases next week. I look at his card. I was like, oh my God, you're Zabar's, you know, it's like, you know.
And I'm so like, a buyer is someone who works at one of these retailers, you know, you mentioned one, you know, but you can imagine like a Whole Foods or a ShopRite.
There's buyers for Whole Foods that walk around. There's buyers for ShopRite that walk around.
And what's their goal? They're looking for interesting new products to put on their shelves or what?
Well, they're looking for interesting products, right? And they're looking for products that might be on trend. They could be coming to the shows saying, hey, we wanna revitalize our sauce category. We wanna revitalize our vitamins. We're looking for, they see either gaps where they need some new, you know, some new faces, or they see where the products are just flying off the shelf. And so they wanna be able to fill those in. Maybe they have a supplier that has been doing well, but they haven't been able to meet demand. So they're looking for other similar suppliers. At the end of the day, it is business. And I can, you know, see, so, you know, I appreciate that. They're looking for products that they believe are going to sell. And either because they have a personal need for it, or they were struck by the brand and saying, you know what, maybe we weren't looking for that kind of product, but that could work. We're going to give them a shot, and maybe we'll give them a chance in one store, regional, nationwide, whatever it is. I mean, we were very, very lucky that when Whole Foods found us at Expo East, and we can definitely get into that, that they decided to take us nationally right away.
Wow.
And I feel like that's fairly unusual, right? Because, and I think there's a couple reasons and ways you can tee yourself up for a larger, you know, distribution. But essentially these buyers are going to these shows. They find brands that they feel are aligned with their values and that are aligned with their customer values. And then they start the dialogue. It doesn't mean you're in. You still have to, the pricing still has to be right. The, you know, the different terms, you have to make sure that they're going to check on your factories. They're going to check on your, you know, your all different kinds of stuff just to make sure that, you know, everything's there. They're also going to want to know, are you a brand that's going to be able to survive? Because it's not cheap to be out there, right? If you're just talking about going to your local deli or local grocery store, that's one thing. But when you're talking about going regionally or nationally to 10, 20, 100, 1,000 stores, it's not cheap. You have to, you know, be ready to invest in terms of marketing, press, PR. And so it's really full court. And so it's, and there's a reason that a lot of brands don't make it out there because they're not ready for that. It's not just about having a great product or a great sell sheet. And the other part is having a website, because you need to make people need to, when, if you're a buyer and you're looking at these brands, maybe you saw someone at a show, or now that there's not shows, what are you going to do? You're going to make a phone call, maybe stop by a store. You need to have some kind of valid presence. And that is when people Google you, they need to find your site, and it needs to look like a real site, like a real, hey, this company, I can actually buy from them. We started out having D2C,
direct to customer, right?
Yeah, direct to customer. Yeah, we started out selling online because I felt it was important that if someone, even the buyer from Zabar's, that they can go back to their computer, go back to their desk, and say, I like that stuff. Let me just see what's going on. Do they have a real website? Are they legit, type of thing? So it's a little bit of a qualification there. And if I know that maybe someone in California or even New Jersey or wherever was interested, they can actually go on, buy it, test it out, and then say, you know what? They have a good product. I met them. They have a good product. They're actually selling direct. Okay, I'm going to take them into my store. So it's a little bit of a de-risking in a way. If I'm a buyer, I'm just thinking through the steps. And I'm a buyer on the other side, I kind of want to qualify them myself as well.
So when you're at these shows and the buyer comes up and they say, you know, I taste your product. It sounded like one of the companies said, you know, send me some. When they said send me some, did they mean send me some so that I can sample it with my team, or I can sell it and see how it performs in the store?
Usually sample it with the team. They're going to do that. So yeah, they're going to want to say, let's test it out. And honestly, how it typically works is there are category reviews. So as you get into any of the chains, there's usually a once a year time period. It might last over the course of a week or a few weeks, but retailers will review different categories at certain points of the year. So, you know, you're going to review your ice creams every January, your frozen, maybe your ice cream and frozen foods in January, maybe your pasta sauces in February, and, you know, different kinds of things. So they'll bucket different times of the year. So these buyers all year long are looking for different types of things to get. And based on what categories they're covering, there's a cycle for that. So, you know, you might, and sometimes you might just miss it. Maybe if you have a new ice cream that you want to put out there and it's February and you're like, okay, now I'm ready to go. I'm ready to start. I got my sell sheet. I'm ready to go. And your biggest, the one you were banking on, just had their review in January. You might be waiting a full 11 months until you have a chance to present. Wow. And then even if you present, you might not be on the shelf. Usually even after you present, you're not on the shelf for about 8 months.
Wow. So
you could have that's why getting out there, hitting the streets, selling locally, grabbing accounts on your own as much as possible is really key in the beginning. You have to be ready to hustle.
So
you
what
have
is
to
this?
Be ready to hustle.
This sounds like a very strange to me, like this idea that you could just walk into, you know, a Whole Foods or some other grocery store. You know, I don't understand what that looks like, and I'm sure some of our listeners don't. So tell us what that's like.
Sure. I mean, Whole Foods, it will be a little bit different. Some of these larger ones, not to say you can't. I mean, there's brands that Whole Foods has foragers, and they'll go out and find local brands and bring you into one or a handful of stores. So you can get in there and work your way from there for sure. The local stores that I'm thinking of are the ones that they are independently run. Like a Zabar's has one store, an iconic store here in New York City. Maybe you'd work with a Murray's Cheese or, you know, some of your favorite local stores. You know, there's a lot of organic or better for you stores that are independently run. If you look up, if you Google Infra, and I think that's independent, it's like an independent group of organic grocers across the United States. And those are ones you can walk right into them. I remember, I love going to Lake Placid upstate with the family. And we went up, maybe it was back in the summer. We just took a trip up there. And my favorite organic store called Green Goddess was there. And of course, I had some sauce on me because you just got to carry your products around, right? And I go in there and I say, hey, and I try not to always be on pitch mode, but it's kind of hard. So, you know, I was in the store and I was like, you know, are you the owner? Yes, of course, the owners are working in those kind of stores. Just want to let you know, I have this product. It's sold. You can buy it from Unify. I would love for you to, and even if it's not sold through a distributor, if I was living there, I would just be able to deliver directly. And I said, can I leave you some? Can you know, and if you like it, here's my information. And she said, sure. She tried it. A week later, she said, we want to take you in. So wow. you can work these stores one-on-one, and sometimes they'll get back to you right away. Sometimes it might take a month or two. Sometimes they have so many things going on. You just have to remind them and just be persistent. But if you believe in your product and it is a good fit, people love to support entrepreneurs. That's what I've seen, you know, throughout my whole life, really. When people see that you're really trying and you're trying to do something that matters, and it's not, you're not a banker and you're not like, this is not a stock transaction. You're just trying to do something that had a genuine reason for being, right? They, how do you not give that person or that brand a chance? Like if I'm on the other side, you got to give them a chance. You have to, right? It's just the good human thing to do. Of course, when you get into those bigger, you know, those bigger conversations and the bigger chains, I mean, that shines through as well. You know, when I go and I'll do my pitches and I'm speaking to buyers, I mean, it's just me talking about what I said in the beginning, like this is what it inspired. Now, the other thing that I'm able to say is now you never have to worry about supply because we can make 100,000 jars in a day, which is a fact. If you want 200,000 jars, give me a 5-week lead time plus a day. You want 300,000, 5 weeks and 2 days.
And that's like, because of your co-manufacturer, right? It's able to do that for you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Our first one was limited to 20,000 in a day. Now, their MOQ, meaning the minimum, they said, Andrew, the minimum you need to order is 2,500 to make it worth it for us to turn on the machines, get the workers and everything ready to go. Mm-hmm. But the maximum, and the reason part of the reason we switched is their maximum was only 20,000 in a day. And so we needed to be able to scale up much quicker in anticipation for bigger orders. Plus I wanted to go fully organic and things like that. So a lot of reasons led us to change and really, you know, that was super big. But being able to go to a buyer and say, I can deliver essentially unlimited product with enough lead time, right? I think puts them at ease. They know they're not dealing with a mom and pop. If they were dealing with a mom and pop, hey, Andrew, we'll try you regionally. We try you in a store too.
Right,
and I think that allows you to have just a different kind of conversation. It's you know, but it does take capital to get there.
And so the timing seems to be relevant here. Like when you're at this trade show and you have the, you know, the one iconic New York store, you can do that, right? Because you have the 2,500, you know, bottles and so on.
Right,
but
if
Whole Foods had walked up to you and said, hey, we really like your product, you know, what are you at? The timing of that conversation would change things because you weren't maybe not in a position to fill that order. So they would have, you know, they would have said, well, how would you like to be in you know, the Whole Foods on 86th Street? And you probably would have been very excited.
And maybe
it would have done well. It sounds like the timing of you were at a place where you were ready to scale. And so when you had that conversation with Whole Foods, you were ready to go. Is this a fair, fair? The capital matters too, right? Because do you have investors lined up? Do you have enough money to get to scale this quickly? So I don't know how this all fits, but there's a lot in there.
Yeah. You know, those are great thoughts. So if Whole Foods or, you know, anyone who wanted a big order came to us at that first food show, I would be ecstatic, but I would always be like, uh-oh, you would kind of have a uh-oh moment because in my gut of guts, I knew when we launched that there would be a time in the near future that I would need to graduate, I would call it. I call it graduating. So I had my first co-packer. It was cool for, let's say, high school, you know, but now we're essentially jumped right to grad school. So we had to like quickly, you know, get a partner that could take us. And quite honestly, right when we launched is when I immediately started really pressing for a new co-packer. Because right when I got to that show and I saw the reactions and even the reactions even prior, the reactions of people seeing the brand for the first time just from the web, and I said, okay, this actually could be something. Immediately I started going on a search, and the reason the next co-packer who has a much higher MOQ, instead of 2,500 jars, it's 20,000, okay, which I would not be able to do right in the beginning.
Right.
Because again, I didn't know if one person wanted it. So I would have in the first round, I would have dismissed them. My co-packer and I went to see them. I mean, a whole team of them that were up there. They told me, they said, Andrew, the president told me, we typically don't take on startups, but something's different here. And essentially we're going to bank on you. Right.
Nice.
We're going to take a gamble. And I tell you how much that meant to me, is probably an understatement, because when someone believes in you, when your family believes in you, when you have, you know, other people, but someone you just met and you only have an hour to chat with them, and it ended up being a half a day. So we had much more time, but when they tell you that, and they don't know you and they don't know all the work that you've done and how much everything means, like, and they tell you that they believe in you, that hits you. And then all you want to do is just win for them. So,
that's,
you know,
awesome.
When we, so when we found our next co-packer, if we had, anyway, go back to that initial line of thinking, if someone like Whole Foods would have met us at that first trade show, we would have had a different trajectory, because we would have most likely been at a smaller place. But as soon as I got a little inkling or feeling that this could be something big, I immediately started looking for a new co-packer. And thankfully we found, you know, these guys and we were off to the races. So the transition took about 6 months.
Uh-huh. And did you need funding to do this? Did you need to go out and get investors when you were ready to scale, or you had already had enough revenue that you were able to move on to the next step, or what?
No, we had to go out and fund. I mean, we had friends and family, but we started to do a seed round. You know, mm-hmm. we did a number of seed rounds, and typically they're done as notes, convertible notes, which are loans, essentially. What I tried to do is not put a valuation on the company, because you don't know. I mean, you could say, yes, this is worth $1 billion, but no one's going to invest in you when you're in a handful of stores, right? So what you do when you're raising capital, at least my approach was, we're going to issue what are called convertible notes. And those convertible notes say, you're essentially loaning the company money that will turn to shares in the future when there's an actual valuation. And what this note says is the valuation will be no higher than, say, $1 million or $2 million or 10, whatever it is, right? And so you can put a fair valuation on it, what you deem as fair, as being a cap. Because what the investor, initial investor, doesn't want to do, they can loan you money, but they don't want it to turn into shares when you're worth $1 billion, because they'll get nothing out of it, right? So right. What you do is you do a note, and there's standard forms and standard templates online that you can use for this. And most lawyers can do it fairly effectively. And you issue convertible notes with a cap. And that cap is what gives investors comfort level that if it blows up in a short term, hey, they're going to convert its shares at that cap level. So if someone gave you if you set $1 million cap on your loan agreement, which is called a convertible note, if you put $1 million cap and someone gave you $100,000, that would effectively be 10%. So, but say you go out and you finally, you know, you issue shares in a few years and you say, okay, it's worth 5 million. It doesn't matter what it's worth at that point, because they are capped. So they are going to get 10% of the company, because that's what you agreed to back then.
And folks who are interested in more about, you know, these kinds of structures, we do have another episode specifically on investment with Ryan Bettencourt. So I encourage folks to look at that. One of the things that you mentions, because we're talking a lot about essentially how to get product on shelves. So, you know, you have the product, you're hustling, you're at these expos, you're walking into stores, you're, you know, gearing up for more production as you grow. You mentioned distributor several times. You mentioned Unify. Where does the distributor fit in? What is Unify? What's that component that we haven't quite touched on yet?
Right. And that's a key one, right? Because or else it sits all in your warehouse and you got to get it. You know, it's interesting. When we went to our first food shows, anyone in New York was great. I would say I'd go drive and I'll kids go to sleep 9, 10 o'clock at night. Are you open at 10? Great. I'm going to go drop it off. And literally that would happen. Like I would run around Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan and go drop off sauce. Right. And that's cool when you're local. But then the problem is you get these emails and you get these calls. I'm in Key West. I'm in California. Can I get your product here and there? And for mine, at least, it's a glass product and it's really hard. We ship direct to home, but those are like four person to four consumer use, you know, but I can't mail 20 jars in a cost effective way so that it can get onto a shelf at a reasonable price. So you need distributors. You need distributors who are going to pick up pallets of your sauce and move them to their warehouses. Unify has 20 plus distribution centers around the United States. So the distributors are key. How it typically works is that when you have a new product, you're going to get a regional distributor. It won't be necessarily Unify yet. It won't be KeHE. It may be, if you're in the Northeast, Chex is a great one. Chex, they still distribute our products because they go to some stores that other people don't. And maybe they cover about 1,000 stores. And it's easier to have a conversation with Chex and say, hey, I have this new thing. Can I incentivize your salespeople? You know, we'll do a promo, 10%, 20% off. And then their sales, then they have a sales force, the distributors that are going to go to these 1,000 stores. Each one covers 10, 20, 30, whatever it is. And they're selling everything. Of course, you know, those stores are also buying from Unify and they're buying from KeHE. But Chex, also a smaller distributor, and buyers know this, they have unique products that might be regional. And they're going to go and they can only get them through Chex. And so they continue to buy them. Maybe Chex will not compete in price for like, for like Cheerios, right? They're going to go to someone else that just buys millions of boxes of Cheerios, but Chex will have those unique products. And so, you know, reaching out and finding who is your local distributor. Talk, you know, an interesting way to find who those distributors are, because I'm sure there's listeners out there from all parts of the country and planet, would be go to your favorite store where your dream would be in and make it in a boutique one, right? And say, and even go to a Whole Foods, because Whole Foods will buy from a smaller distributor, not just Unify, and say, hey, if I wanted to, like, who do you buy your stuff from? I have a product. My dream is one day to be on your shelf. Can you just tell me who do you buy from? What are the three or four companies that you buy from? And then they give you that list and you go back. And then when you have your product ready and you have your sell sheet ready and you have your website ready, your next call could and probably should be to one of those distributors. Either you're calling them or you hire a broker to make those phone calls for you.
And just so I understand the ecosystem here. So in the way that you went to these stores personally initially, yeah. and some sort of tried to sell products, are you saying that the distributor will help you increase the number of stores that take on the product? Are you also saying that they will also handle the actual delivery of those products? Is that both?
Yes. When I was really, really starting, And we had pallets of sauce outside my house that we would lug upstairs and I would have local distributor coming to my house and load up their vans, and we would, you know, load up his van and he would go to 10, 20 stores, you know. So initially it was me taking the sauce from my car, and going there. Then I would have a distributor. Then you reach the point where you're getting semi trucks going to your processing plant, and it becomes a different game.
But once you have a distributor, and is this essentially right that like there's a facility that produces the product, and then does the distributor come and actually pick it up, or does the facility send it to the distributor and then bring it
either
to
one.
The store? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Either one. We do both. We'll sometimes deliver. So we'll coordinate the freight between our factory and the distributor, or the distributor will come up. Honestly, what typically happens now is our product goes to our warehouse, and our warehouse is very structured. We know which pallets were manufactured on what date and what SKU it is, and so it's fairly computerized. And so people are going to either our warehouse to pick it up with appointments and things like that. And they might say, hey, we want to take one pallet, we want to take a layer, we want to have a mixed pallet, those kind of things. That's why getting a key warehouse later on is key. In the meantime, you got to get your hands dirty. To appreciate what you build, you have to get your hands dirty. That's just my opinion, right? Or else you're never going to appreciate, you're never going to struggle, you're never going to really understand when there's an issue at a warehouse or there's an issue with something else. Like, unless you've had that issue yourself, how are you going to empathize with another human being without being there and done that?
The warehouse component is if you're not selling product fast enough. Like when you first order that 2,500 jars, I don't know if they were sitting in your house or a warehouse, but more that you like, do you have a warehouse now after all this time?
Yes.
Still need a warehouse.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because you need to, you always have to have a backup of a product, and the product, it have to be at the ready. So our lead time to make our product is 5 weeks. So typically when you make a co-packer, there's a certain amount of lead time to get the ingredients and things like that, right? Because they're working with a whole bunch of different brands and companies. Now, but your lead time with a store, or your lead time with Unify or something like that, is typically 2 or 3 weeks. So there could be, you have to have a backlog of inventory that you're ready to spend. You have to have a forecast that, and that's why the capital comes into key, right? Because you need to spend on making product before it's actually bought. And there's a balance where we got thrown off in a good way, I guess. But it was also challenging is when one of the key things I would really recommend is QVC. Mm. So I was on QVC, and I used to not, you know, my friend's parents used to watch it as I was a kid and everything.
My mom likes QVC. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Right. And they have such a dedicated base of viewers that when we're on QVC, you cannot believe, I mean, how much product they can move. And all of a sudden what you were expecting to sell that month, you get this blip and you're like, uh-oh. and then you have to go make product. And then we actually were scheduled for a double header last summer. We were on 15 times last year, though, most recently on December 30th. And it's great. But we had a conundrum where I'd promised Whole Foods, hey, we're going to be slotted with Whole Foods. And QVC came in and said, we want to put you on a double header. And I had just enough to give Whole Foods for their first order. I was not going to short Whole Foods. Right. So I had to turn down the QVC show. And that stunk.
But that's such a good example of what happens, right? You really
lost sales. And our biggest show on QVC, I sold 20,000 jars in 8 minutes. 20,000 jars in 8 minutes. Wow. So and it stinks to have to turn down like a double header and things like that. But on the other hand,
if you have too much inventory, I'm sure there are situations where people have too much inventory. Maybe the expiration date goes, they can't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And your expiration date will have you're going to have a contract with your distributor that says, when we take your product, you still have X amount of days on your distribution, X amount of percentage of your days. So, just because it hasn't expired yet, doesn't mean you can still sell it. They might want to have like 75% of, the shelf life on it when it comes in their warehouse. Or guess what? You got to find another way to flip it.
Interesting. Well, it's been amazing speaking with you. I can't believe we're already out of time, but this has just been so helpful in thinking about how to build a brand and really how to get your product out there and get it on shelves into consumers' hands. So I thank you for all the great work that you're doing. Andrew, your company and product is amazing. And I thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Reducetarian podcast. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Brian.